It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new WPR special looks at the relationship between the Green Bay Packers and their fans. We'll talk to two of the WPR hosts behind the project and hear from a video journalist who's been on the field and in the locker room at Lambeau for decades. First, numbers are all over the news, from polling and political campaigns to ever more elaborate sports statistics to rates of COVID tests and vaccinations. If we're not mathematically inclined, it can be easy to gloss over the numbers and either accept them at face value or to be skeptical, since it can seem like we can do anything with statistics. But our next guest says we're missing out if we skip the data, and he's got a new podcast that can help us out. Spoiler, he starts with ghosts. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you ever feel baffled when you run into that string of numbers and data and charts in a news story or a sports story? Or do you love that stuff? You can't get enough of it. Either way, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Harry Enten is back with us. He's a senior data reporter at CNN. He's got a new podcast out. It's called Margins of Error. Harry, welcome back to Central Time.
I feel like I'm joining old family. How you doing, buddy?
Great. It's good to have you back. And you're doing well. You got this new podcast.
We do have this new podcast, Margins of Error, which you mentioned. And, you know, the truth is that over the last, you know, year and a half, we've been dealing with so many hard news stories in which numbers have been applied. And I wanted to branch out a little bit and show that the numbers can tell us a lot more about the world around us beyond just the hard news like COVID or the presidential election.
Well, Harry, I've known all along you're a data superhero, but I never knew your origin story. When did you first fall in love with numbers and the stories that they tell?
You know, it's a great question insofar as I think there are multiple different stages in which I fell in love, right? You know, obviously, I went into the voting booth with my father when I was 4 years old, and I loved the idea of pulling the levers on the lever machines, and that was all fun and jazz. But as I got older, you know, I must admit, I struggled a lot in school when it came to essay writing. And I just couldn't, you know, themes, motifs, that type of thing was all very, very difficult for me. And what I discovered was I could, in fact, make really good arguments through numbers, prove things through numbers. You know, in a world in which there are a lot of, you know, a lot of misinformation and falsehoods, numbers can cut right through it. And I'm able to build an argument through numbers and tell a lot about the world surrounding us through those numbers.
Before we get into the podcast more deeply, Harry, I think people can be suspicious that you can make the numbers do what you want with them, and you can tell whatever story you want with the numbers. How can we, the lay people, as we're looking at a data-driven story, kind of try to figure out for ourselves, am I being flim-flammed here, or is this legit stuff?
You know, I guess you can always be flim-flam, but my general advice on whether or not you should trust the numbers, you know, is probably the same advice I would give with news stories in general, right? If you're hearing these numbers from a source you've never heard about before, a person who you've never heard of, who's not with a news organization you trust, then I would be a little bit suspicious. If it's from a reporter that you trust, from a news organization that you trust, and there seems to be, you know, not just one number, but perhaps a slew of numbers so that they can tell a complete story, so it's not just an outlier statistic, I think that to me is what I generally look for. And the other thing, you know, I would say just on polling in general is always, an average is better than any individual poll, and an average of data points in real life is better than one individual anecdote.
Harry Enten is with us, senior data reporter at CNN. We're talking about his new podcast, Margins of Error, where he digs into numbers behind stories and helps us make sense of it all. You can join in if you have a question about how to interpret the numbers you might see out in the world. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Want to dig into your podcast, Harry. And this is an important point. Before we give a listen to something, you know, I think of you as a political guy, right? And kind of a sports guy, too. You are not just looking at politics here. Why was it important to you to branch out from that?
Yeah, in fact, we only have one story the entire season in which it's strictly a political story. 7 of the 8 episodes are not about politics. And, you know, the reason to me it was so important was that I think life is a lot more than just politics. It's a lot more than just the coronavirus. There are a lot of stories out there, and I wanted my work to reflect that. And I believe that the podcast does exactly that, including in the clip that you'll be playing.
Well, you said life isn't just about that politics, and also the afterlife isn't just about politics. Your first episode is about ghosts, and here's a listen to your setup on that.
There's a belief that there was a ghost boy, a boy who was killed by a passing car. And the belief is that if I throw coins into the body of water below, that the ghost boy will throw the coins back at me. Shall we do it? Let's do it. That's one coin. It's two coins. That's two coins that I've just thrown in there. And you know what? I'm a believer in luck, so let's toss a third coin for good luck and see if the coins come back.
Well, I won't spoil it and say whether or not Ghost Boy threw those coins back at you, Harry, but why did you tackle ghosts in your first episode?
First, let me just say, that was the freakiest drive I ever took. It's West Milford, New Jersey. You know, I live in New York. I had to drive all the way out there on this dark road. And at some point, there were a bunch of high schoolers who came out. And I was like, what is going on here? And this light was coming out of the forest. You know, look, to me, what it was, I actually had a producer. It came with an interesting stat. And he said, you know that nearly 50% of Americans believe in ghosts now? And I said, there's no way that's true. And I actually looked it up, and it turns out it's true. And not only that, but the percentage of Americans who believe in ghosts has climbed exponentially since the late 70s, when it was only about 10%. So we've seen nearly a 40-point increase. And I was just interested in this episode is, why has there been this increase in the percentage of Americans who believe in ghosts? And, you know, I think this episode, which was the first one we did, sort of speaks to what the pod is about. That is that the numbers are a way in, but they are not the entire story. You know, in each episode, we do a bunch of interviews. We speak with the people who are experiencing what the numbers suggest are going on. And so in that episode, you know, we speak with someone who believes in ghosts. We speak with some experts who help us to understand why ghost belief is up. But, you know, it really, as you listen to the episode, and I hope your listeners will, the fact that ghost belief is up speaks to a number of trends that we're seeing throughout society. So, the percentage who believe in ghosts is just the way into a larger story.
What is it about a number like that, that the percentage of people who believe in ghosts has just had that huge jump? What is it that makes you sit up and say, take notice and say, this means something, and we have to figure out what?
You know, it passes, first off, it's sort of the gut test, which is this number seem sort of interesting and different than what I might expect? And the fact that nearly 50% of Americans now say they believe in ghosts was something that made me sit up and say, wow, that's much higher than I expected. And then essentially what happens is, you know, I go into research mode, right? I look back, I try and see, okay, is that number higher or lower? Okay, it's much higher than it used to be. What are some trends that are going on in society that may help explain that? You know, each of the episodes, even though they're, you know, about 30 minutes in runtime, including commercials, even though it's that short of a period of time, so you really can get a lot in a small period of time, it takes a lot of time to produce these episodes. And what you're really getting is sort of the meat. You don't have to worry about your vegetables. You're getting your ice cream sundae. You're getting your steak in the episode. And we really figure out what's really driving these numbers. And so there's a lot of work that goes into it. You know, it was very possible when we first heard that stat, the story might have not gone anywhere. But the fact was, there's in fact a lot to the story, and you get to hear that in the first episode.
Right, something that might leap to people's minds is, well, can we trust the polls there? Was there something about the way we asked about ghosts in, I don't know, 1970 different than we ask about them now? Or are different agencies doing? Has something changed in our measurement, not in our reality? How do we tease out, whether we're talking about ghosts or support for a political candidate or whatever, how do we tease that out?
You know, I must admit, when I was looking at it, I sort of said, okay, the first poll in 1978 was conducted by Gallup. And, you know, it's obviously a prominent pollster. For a long time, they interviewed face-to-face, then they interviewed by phone. And now a lot of the polls that ask about ghost belief are ones essentially in which they're being asked online. And so, yes, the way in which the questions are being asked is different. The methodology is a little bit different. The questions themselves, sometimes they're asked in some ways, sometimes they're asked in others. And so in that type of situation, what I did was I literally gathered every single question I could on it, In the Roper Archives, which is a large archive of polling, both politics and non-politics, going back since the late 1930s. And I said, okay, am I just seeing an outlier data point here, or is there something real going on? And what you can literally see, if you were to chart it out, you can see that the line increases in a very clear 45-degree angle. And that is that the increase is clear across time. And so it became clear to me that this wasn't just an artifact of the question, the way the question was being asked, wasn't just an artifact of the methodology. But, you know, when you're looking at all these types of things, what I always suggest is that you try and look at all the polls that are available. You average at the end of the day, but you keep in mind that the average isn't always going to be perfect. You really should look at the range of polls so that if, let's say, one poll has a candidate down one and another one has that candidate up 10, the truth is probably in between. That candidate's probably up by, you know, 5 or 6 points, but it's quite conceivable that person, that candidate, is actually trailing.
We're talking to CNN senior data reporter Harry Enten about his new podcast about statistics and numbers in our lives, not just about politics either. It's called Margins of Error. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we talked about ghosts. How about daylight savings time? Do you believe in that? Do you want it to stay or go? That's the next episode we'll take a look at. And bigger picture, do you have a question about polls and numbers in our lives and how to assess them when we see them in a news story? Are you a big fan of digging into the statistics of political polling, professional sports, you name it? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with CNN senior data reporter Harry Enten. His new podcast is called Margins of Error. Tackles a lot of different numbers in the news and beyond and how we interpret them. You can join in if you have a question or thought at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Harry, we heard from Tom in Milwaukee, who is interested in numbers and data behind a big topic, COVID-19 deaths. He's interested in seeing the breakdown of Republicans versus Democrats, how that fits into the bigger picture where we just hear that politics is often wrapped up in whether or not people get vaccinated. A lot of charts and numbers going on out there about that, Harry. I don't know how close you followed it since you're busy making a podcast. But what thoughts do you have for Tom?
These are the thoughts that I would have. First off, obviously, we know that more Democrats have gotten vaccinated than Republicans. Obviously, at the beginning of the pandemic, what we saw were deaths largely in blue states, states like New Jersey and New York. Since that point, especially over the last few months, what we've generally seen is that, number one, the red states have tended to have higher death tolls more recently than the blue states did. And even within a particular state, what you tend to be seeing is that the counties that voted more heavily for Trump have had higher death rates than the counties that voted for Biden. I believe that's also true in Wisconsin, which, of course, shouldn't be surprising insofar as that the vaccination rates tend to be higher in those blue counties than in those red counties. When it comes to individuals, obviously, that's a bit tougher. You know, it doesn't say on the death certificate whether a person was a Democrat or a Republican. But I would say that if at the beginning of the pandemic, the deaths tended to be concentrated among places that voted Democratic, at this particular point, the deaths, at least the more recent deaths, tend to be concentrated among the counties and places that vote more Republican.
Tom, thanks for passing that question along at 800-642-1234. Okay, Harry, you took us on your ghost tour there. Now you dug into our clocks. Let's take a listen to I believe this is the second chapter of Margins of Error.
How do you feel about daylight saving time and or the changing of the clocks?
A lot of times during falling back, people break their clocks because they go the wrong way or they are fiddling with it and then something goes wrong. So we do get a little bump in business on daylight, you know, saving and standard time when they switch back and forward.
That's Sebastian Laws, owner and horologist at the Sutton Clock Shop. At any one time, the guy is surrounded by 300 to 500 clocks in various stages of repair. I figured if anyone has the right to complain about changing the clocks, it's him.
All right, Harry, what was the core question that led you to tackle daylight savings time?
And I should note, it's saving.
There's, oh my goodness.
There's, it's not a plural. You're saving time. You're not saving time.
Over. That's it.
It's all over. The fact checks are in. That's in fact one of the myths we bust in the episode. There are a lot of myths around daylight saving time that we bust, including the fact that it's for farmers, the fact that Ben Franklin was the main inventor of it. All those tend to be false upon closer examination. Look, the deal for me was actually really simple. I love sleep, and I don't get enough of it. And a few months ago, essentially, I got woken up. I was in bed, and I was like, darn, it's later than I wish it were. And I realized that if it were not for daylight saving time, the clocks would have been an hour, it would have been an hour earlier. And so this has long been an issue for me in terms of trying to understand why the heck do we have this system whereby in the fall you fall back and in the spring you spring forward. And this whole episode is sort of looking at why does a system exist in which 70% of Americans do not like the idea that we change the clocks twice a year. And so we really just dig deep into it and try to understand whether or not it's the right system for us. And if it isn't, what direction should we be going in?
Is there any thought that we're going to get rid of spring forward, fall back, Harry?
Well, there has been some legislation in the United States Senate that actually wants to move us towards permanent daylight saving time. That is, we would never change the clocks. We would not fall back in the winter time, the fall time. Whether or not that goes anywhere, ultimately, who is to say? At this particular point, the law actually allows you to stay on standard time all year round, which much of Arizona and the state of Hawaii do, but it does not allow you to be on daylight saving time all year round. Whether or not we actually end up getting to that point, who is to really say? But I will say, if you listen to the episode, you'll find that there are a lot of people who feel very strongly about this issue.
Talking to Harry Enten from CNN. His new podcast is called Margins of Error. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Catherine is with us in Madison. Catherine, hi.
Hi. First of all, I have to say I'm dying to listen to the podcast about the ghosts. Fascinating. I'm calling because my question is this. Whenever confronted with a poll of the sort that says, do you approve or disapprove of such and such, or, you know, other kind of binary choices, I just won't answer them because I can't, because my feelings on those complex subjects cannot be summarized in either yes or no. And I just wondered how that sort of those, you know, there's a place for forced choice in some kinds of tests, but in others, I feel as though that must distort the results to some extent. And I would love to hear Mr. Enson's comment on that issue.
Catherine, great question. I think people often might wonder, why do you do a yes or no, approve or disapprove, versus a range from strongly approve to strongly disapprove?
It's a great question, and I appreciate being called Mr. My God. I feel so grown up today. What I would say to this is a fewfold. Number one, there are some questions, right, in which you ask, you know, a strongly approve, somewhat approve, somewhat disapprove, strongly disapprove. Those may mostly have to do with, do you approve of a politician or not? I actually tend to like questions that leave open the possibility, number one, where it's very clearly stated that you can say, I don't know. And I also like questions in which, especially non-political questions, where you can sort of give a range of your positivity or negativity. You know, there was an old CBS News, when they asked about the favorability ratings, they'd say, do you have a favorable rating, unfavorable rating? You don't know enough to rate. Or you've never heard of this person. I like that. When it comes to, you know, differing questions about, you know, would something make you more or less likely to get a COVID-19 vaccine among the unvaccinated? You know, you could say it will make me more likely. It'll make me somewhat more likely. It won't make a difference. It'll make me somewhat less likely or a lot less likely. I think, though, on the overall thing, when it comes to approving or disapproving of a politician, you know, especially the president of the United States, I think that that dual question, approve, disapprove, gets you a lot of the way there. But when it comes to particular questions that I don't think a lot of people have given that much time to, I think that's when it's time to break out sort of not just the dual binary choice of approve, disapprove, but introducing the don't know, introducing the idea that you might be neutral, and also introducing the idea of a scale so that you can essentially say, you know what, I like that, but I don't necessarily love that.
Thanks for that call, Catherine. Let's go now to Jeff in Superior. Jeff, hey.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Say, you know, we live in a beautiful part of the world, and the way to enjoy it, in my opinion, is to somehow escape from the day-to-day things where everything's being measured and everything's being, you know, sold or bought. And my family, my extended family, my grandmother had a cabin. We would go, there was no clock, there was no phone. And when you went there, you were, you know, sunrise to sunset, you ate when you're hungry and you slept when you were tired. And it was a way to get away from the world, and she really taught us something that was lasting. And I wondered if you, what you thought about that. I wanted to share that with you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Timelessness, Harry, it sounds lovely to me as a human. It sounds scary to me as a radio guy. I don't know. What do you think, having talked about time for a while? Do you think you could appreciate some time without a clock?
Oh, God, I would love time without a clock. I'd absolutely love that idea of being able to unplug. I will admit, as I sit here, you know, on 34th Street in Manhattan or 33rd Street in Manhattan, the idea of being able to unplug sounds very appealing, also very difficult. But, you know, I don't want to make this, you know, bring it back to the podcast completely.
Well,
but
should.
I will say, you know, when it comes to the podcast and why I wanted to do what I did, it was because I really did want an escape from the day-to-day grind of the hard news cycle. There's a time and a place for that. But I really wanted to be able to go on an adventure with the listeners and be able to explore things that make up the rest of life. Because again, the hard news stories, again, are important, but they make up just a small fraction of our life. And being able to go and tell the story of going up on a, you know, a road in the middle of nowhere, New Jersey, I think that kind of gets at the idea that there's a lot more to life that oftentimes doesn't get spoken about in the media.
We'll leave it there, Harry. Thanks again. Good to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
Harry Enten is a senior data reporter at CNN. We talked to him today about his new podcast he's hosting, looking at some of the stories behind facts, figures, and statistics. It's called Margins of Error, two episodes up so far, Ghosts and Time. Coming up after the news, we'll hear part of a WPR special about the connection between the Green Bay Packers and their fan base in Wisconsin and beyond. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, it's this week's edition of Ask a Contractor. With a timely topic, find out the best ways to get your home ready for winter. Join in with your questions. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, for more than 100 years, the people of Wisconsin have been cheering on one organization, apart from Wisconsin Public Radio, the Green Bay Packers. The team has a special place in Wisconsin culture, thanks in large part to its connection with the fans. WPR's regional bureaus recently teamed up to learn more about that relationship. The result is a special called The People and Their Packers. It aired around parts of the state last week, and we're going to hear some of that in just a bit here on Central Time. First, two of the WPR hosts behind the project are with us now. Shireen Seward is host of Route 51 in Wausau. She's also editor of the Wausau Pilot and Review. Shireen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And Ezra Wallace, host of Newsmakers in La Crosse and our regional manager there. Ezra, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Ezra, the Packers, no secret, big deal in Wisconsin. They get talked about a lot on sports radio every week. You're going beyond the X's and O's here, though. Can you talk about what you were looking for in this special?
Yeah, well, I spent a lot of time working in sports radio before I began my public radio career, and it's mostly second-guessing of coaches and players and evaluation of performance on the field, performance of the referees. All of that gets wrapped up into your typical sports radio conversation with a healthy dose of yelling back and forth to one another. And we kind of wanted to sidestep all of that and get more to like the culture of the team and what really connects the organization with not just the community in Green Bay, but really the whole community throughout Wisconsin.
With that in mind, Shireen, what sort of people did you look to talk to?
We wanted to talk to people who could really speak to what it is that makes the relationship between the Packers and their fans so unique. Because I'll tell you, if you grow up in Wisconsin, you just think that every team has this kind of support. And it wasn't until I was older and traveled a bit and went to some other stadiums and that I realized that that is not the case. This is a very, very loyal fan base that is not like anything else out there. So we wanted to explore that. What is it? So we talked to some fans from inside the state. We talked to some fans from outside the state. And a guy from California who moved to Green Bay, became a season ticket holder, became a shareholder, and is the head of a 12,000-person Southern California Packer fan group on Facebook. Like, what is that? So it was just really wonderful to talk to these people and get their perspective and find out just what it is that made the Green Bay Packers so special to their lives.
Well, that's a pretty good fan story there. Ezra, was there a fan story you heard that stood out to you?
Absolutely. We talked to a woman named Annie Knowlton, and she's actually a Packer fan from the Twin Cities in Minnesota. Ooh. And so she talked about just sort of establishing herself. She had been raised in a split household, Rob, where there were Packer fans and Viking fans, and so being in that community, feeling isolated, and then finally using social media to kind of connect with other Packer fans. Now they meet up every year, except for last year, obviously. They go to games, they do all kinds of different things, but more importantly than that, it's been a real community for Annie to find support for the group grieving together over the death of a friend, and even support through her own journey with cancer. It was just really touching to hear how something as seemingly superficial as watching people throw a ball around a field could really become something meaningful.
Shireen, as you mentioned, it's different among Packers fandom, I think, than any other NFL team. Did you start to figure out what the secret sauce was? What is it about the Packers?
I think there's something about the fact that this is the NFL's only community-owned team. The people really, truly own this team. They are so proud of that. And actually, one of the fans said it best. He said, "This team will break your heart, but they will never leave you." And I thought, that's exactly it. I mean, they are our team.
And Ezra, you're on the opposite side of the state from Green Bay, but that doesn't matter, right?
No, I was raised, in fact, I've been a Packer fan since the day I was born in 1977. You know, you are born a Packer fan in our household, and I've spent my life cheering for them. I lived out of state for a long time, and the internet didn't exist before I moved out of state. And so I've never, ever been to a regular season game in Lambeau Field, and yet I still bleed green out of one arm and gold out of the other one.
Shireen, this is a collaboration among WPR regional bureaus around the state. Can you tell us a little bit about how the project came together?
Well, I've been thinking about this for a while. I've been thinking about it for a couple of years since I was in Nashville and wanted to go to a game there. And I couldn't believe how many seats were available. And I started to think about that. Why is it different there than it is here? And then I thought, okay, this is something I'd like to explore on Route 51. But then I thought, it's more of a statewide thing. So we reached out to Ezra, and we talked about doing it as a regional project and worked together to make it a more complete program. And we were really excited about the guests that we had.
Ezra, you mentioned you were a sports radio guy. I would love to call a Packer game sometime, even though I'd be terrible at it. Would that be like a life dream for you?
Actually, I would be terrible at it as well. I spent my entire time in sports radio as a producer, but I would love to sit in the booth during a Packer game and just watch how everything happens. And running a board has been my favorite thing to do for years, so I would love to push all the buttons.
Shireen, what do you think? Should WPR try to win the Packers radio contract?
Oh, you bet. You bet. 100%.
But then we'd all be fighting with each other over who got to actually do it week in and week out.
I think we'd have to take turns.
All right. Shireen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And Ezra, thanks for sharing this with us.
Certainly.
Ezra Wall is WPR's host of Newsmakers in La Crosse. Shireen Seward is host of Route 51 in Wausau. They talked to us about the WPR special they collaborated on, The People and Their Packers. Coming up, we'll hear their conversation with the Packers historian and a journalist who's had a front row seat to the team for decades. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're talking about the people and their Packers, a recent special from WPR's regional bureaus that looks at the relationship between the Green Bay Packers and their fans. We just heard from hosts Ezra Wall and Shereen Seewert. Now we'll hear their conversation with Keith Donovan, an Emmy-winning video journalist, about his years covering the team. They also talked with team historian Cliff Crystal about fan support during the Packers' early years. He said that although we take sellout crowds at Lambeau Field for granted today, that was not always the case.
One of the things that I learned in my research that I really wasn't aware of was the Packers were not unlike the other small town teams in the league that folded. There really were not enough people in Green Bay to support the team. So Packers struggled with attendance for several years, even into the early 1950s. In the 1920s, they didn't always outdraw the East-West high school football rivalry, which was really, Press Gazette would refer to as the biggest game of the year in Green Bay. But when they started winning in New York, when they went there in 1929, they played the Giants in a late November showdown. Both teams were unbeaten. Packers, I believe, were 9-0. The Giants 8-0-1. And the Packers beat the Giants and went on to win their first NFL title. In the process, they captured the fancy of the fans in New York. And what saved the franchise really was over the next several years, when NFL games are being attended by roughly 12,000 people, most games, in fact, drew less than that, the Packers were drawing more than 30,000 in New York and Chicago.
So in your years covering the team as a journalist and now as the team's historian, what have you seen in terms of interactions between the fans and the players? Is there a moment that stands out to you?
I think what's interesting is the number of fans who come from out of town to attend the games. I'm not sure exactly what percentage of fans from Green Bay are actually in the stadium on a Sunday afternoon, but I would not be surprised if the number is less than 50%. I mean, Lambeau Field is a pilgrimage.
Cliff Crystal is the Packers team historian and the author of the forthcoming book, The Greatest Story in Sports. Cliff, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And now we're joined by Keith Donovan. Keith grew up in Rhinelander, graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, and went on to a career in video journalism, one that took him to the sidelines, covering his favorite team both home and away.
Growing up in Rhinelander, I mean, we were not the wealthiest family in the world. I never even got to go to a Packer game. So the first time I ever went to a Packer game, I was covering it. So I got to walk down the ramp and be right there on the field. And I mean, it was just tingling. It was the coolest thing.
You got to take your dad with you to a game as well.
Funny thing is you'd think that there'd be other people that would want to take their Saturday and go to the game with, or Sunday, excuse me, and go to the game with me. But I couldn't get anyone else that was willing to do that because, you know, you're in the locker room and you're doing interviews and you had to have somebody hold the mic for you and stuff. And it was hard for me to get somebody on a regular basis to do that. So I actually asked my father if he'd want to go do that with me. And I mean, it was awesome for him. Like I said, growing up for us, vacationing was camping, you know. So for us to go to the Packers game together, he could be on the sidelines with me and then we'd be in the locker room and he'd get to see all these players up front and personal. And it was great. And, you know, like being in the break room on Monday, the guys would all be just, you know, goofing around talking about the game and, you know, somebody would go, did you see that play? I mean, what was Favre thinking? And my dad could kind of joke around and go, well, you know, when I asked him on Sunday, he'd say, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, he never really got to ask them, but he could at least, you know, put, you know, taunt that he was at the game and they weren't. So it was kind of cool.
So when you're on the field as a videographer, as a photojournalist, do you have to kind of watch out for flying objects?
You're not that far removed from the sidelines. And there was actually one time, I'm not sure who it was, but I was doing what I had said. I was doing some ISOs and I was following a person. And you can almost kind of tell when they're not going to get the ball because, you know, they start off really fast and then you can kind of tell they just let up a little bit because they don't want to use up all their juice for the game, you know, stuff. And I could tell it was not coming my way. But then all of a sudden, somebody, I don't know if it was an officer or somebody else behind me, because we have to kneel at Lambeau. And somebody grabbed me by the back of the neck or collar and just kind of pulled me down backwards. And at first I was so angry. I was like, what are you doing? And then I saw the cleats fly over me, ahead, over the top of me. And, you know, the play was coming my way, and you hold the camera on your right side. And so my right side was my blind side, and I couldn't see the play coming my way. And if they hadn't done that, you know, who knows, I would have been, you know,
cleats to the head.
Yeah, I would have been embedded into the turf, basically.
You got to cover the Super Bowl back when the Packers were playing in New Orleans. Tell us about that.
Yep, New Orleans, and the following year in San Diego. So a win and a loss. It was amazing. It was so at the time I worked for a local Fox affiliate. It was the first ever Super Bowl on Fox, and I was there for 2 weeks down in New Orleans. And again, it's a 3 day city. You know, you go there for 3 days and it's fun, but I was there for 2 weeks. And then being on the sidelines, it's very aggressive actually for photographers. I mean, photographers are vying for position. You have to run ahead. You can't like hold a spot or anything like that. You have to run ahead, and you have to have some intuition too. You have to kind of know or think, you know, where the play is going to be. Also you're looking at the clock and you see that there's only maybe 10 seconds left in the quarter, and there's maybe, you know, 15 or 20 seconds left on the play clock. You know, they're not going to get a playoff, and they're down on the 10 yard line. So you have to literally do a 100 yard sprint, you know, to get to the other end of the stadium, because they're going to switch sides and you're going to be stuck on the opposite end of the field. So you literally sprint to the other end. And not just at a Super Bowl, when the Packers were really popular, there was just as many people on the sidelines as there were a Super Bowl. And you have to get there and you got to get your spot. And it, a lot of competition for that. People are bumping you and pushing you around and stuff.
What's it like in the locker room after a Packer win?
I mean, after a Packer win, they're all happy and fun. And a lot of times you can get people to talk. I mean, obviously the quarterback, I mean, I can't honestly remember ever seeing Brett in the locker room, because they always bring them out and they have them on the podium. And I don't even know if, to this day, I don't even know if their area is in the main area, because I would never see them in there. But they're goofing around and they're having a good time and laughing. The tough part was on a loss, because we still had to go in there and we still had to talk to them. And, you know, we had to do our job, and they don't want to hear you ask those tough questions. They don't want to have to do it, but we still have to do it. And sometimes that was really tough. And it was really tough when they lost to Denver in the Super Bowl. I mean, great, it was all fun when they won in New Orleans, but the following year when they lost to Denver, and that was at the time, it was considered one of the best Super Bowls. Most Super Bowls are blowouts and it's not a great game, but that one was considered a really good game. And you could hear a pin drop in that locker room. And most people didn't even want to talk to him, didn't want to ask questions. That was a tough day.
We talked to people for this program from all over the place who are Packer fans. I mean, there are 12,000 Packer fans in a Southern California group that get together and watch games and connect with one another. After covering the Packers for so many years, what do you think it is about the team that has appeal that reaches so far beyond Wisconsin's borders?
Maybe part of it is that while, you know, any team in the NFL is big business, the Packers are the only team that is not owned by, you know, like a one person or a certain entity. It's owned by the people. And it's in a very small, small town. And I think people feel like it's our team, you know, it's not one person's team, and everybody just feels like they're part of something. And I think there's a lot to that, especially like if it's a close game or something like that. It's not the Packers won. I mean, we all won. I don't know if we have time to talk about it, but there's one game for me that sticks out more so than any Super Bowl or anything like that. And I think Shireen and I had shared a video of this that I had shot before, but this was a Vikings Packers regular season game. It was November 6, 2000. And it was November. It was cooler, super windy, raining. It was raining sideways. And it looked like the Vikings were going to win. I mean, there's like 8 seconds left in the game and it was tied and they're about to kick a field goal from somewhere in the 30-yard line. But the snap was bobbled and the holder decided to try to do some sort of a pass and was intercepted and the game ended in a tie. Packers won the toss. And so obviously, you know, sudden death rules back then were heading down. And Favre on third down, he threw a pass to Antonio Freeman. And the pass was deflected and Freeman did a face plant. He slid on the ground. And everybody thought this play is over. The ball lands on Antonio's back. And somehow he spins around and grabs the ball before it hits the ground. And it's considered a catch. But everybody, the stadium, the announcers, even me, and it happened literally right in front of me, everybody thought it was a dead play, but it was a reception. And because there wasn't a Viking near him, he actually got up and he ran the distance into the end zone. And sudden death, we won. And I mean, the fans went crazy. I mean, there's enough electricity in that stadium to power half of Wisconsin. I mean, it was just amazing. You know, at the end of the game, you get to run onto the field with your camera and stuff. And I was just going from player to player and running up there and just to see the excitement and the electricity in the air. I mean, it was something that I will never, ever experience again in my life.
You've talked about shooting the players, shooting the field action. What about the fans? You ever turn the camera around on the fans, or do you ever get an opportunity to see interaction between the players and the fans?
You do a little bit, and that's kind of the fun part. You don't always get to do that. There's a few occasions you get to do that. But there's one thing that stands out for me, and it happens every year, and honestly, anybody can take part in this. You don't have to have a ticket to a game to take part in this, and that's training camp. Every year, the Packers, they get ready at the stadium, and then they walk across the parking lot to the Don Hutson Center, and they have practice over there. And they have it set up where people can stand there and kind of watch the players come out and stuff. And this is so stinking cute. There's these kids with their little bikes that kind of come over there, and these players, the kids will stand there, and you know, these players are towering big, huge linemen and stuff that weigh hundreds and hundreds of pounds. And there's these little tykes with their bikes, and they're almost looking straight up at the sky at these guys, and they hand them their bikes, and these big guys will hop on these bikes, and their knees are as they're trying to ride the bike are practically hitting them in the chin, and the kid will like hop alongside of them and they'll ride that bike across the parking lot all the way over to practice, and then they hand the bike over to the kid. And it's just one of the greatest things you can possibly witness. And again, it's free. Happens almost every day during training camp. If anyone has nothing going on, I encourage you to go up and check it out.
Photojournalist Keith Donovan has been in the television industry for years and spent many of them covering the Packers on the sidelines. Keith, thanks very much for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
We also heard from WPR hosts Ezra Wall and Shereen Seward as part of the special they produced called The People and Their Packers. You can hear more from that special tomorrow on The Morning Show. Mark Tauscher talks about his journey from Packers fan to player, and we hear from the head of a Packer fan club in California. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, most school kids deal with homework, sometimes lots and lots of homework. But does it really help with learning, or is it just busy work? We'll check in on the latest research in the ongoing homework debate. And creativity can make life a lot more fun, and it can help us solve problems in our lives. We'll get inspiration from the author of the new book called Creative Acts for Curious People. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Is it too soon to think about Halloween? According to my local grocery and drug stores, the answer is no, it is not too soon. They've had candy building up for like a month now. And according to streaming services, some people are kicking off a month-long viewing of scary movies. But not everybody's on board, including Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, Rob.
I understand you are not a big fan of the scary movies.
Correct. That is right. I always get in trouble because I think that I can hang for them, and then flashbacks from those movies terrorize me for months and months after.
Wow. I don't watch a lot of them anymore. I used to be more into them. Is there one that really, I don't know, scarred you or really bugged you for a while?
Well, there's one that is currently bugging me, and that is M. Night Shyamalan's movie Split. And all I will say about that movie is that James McAvoy's character has some very scary food preferences. And to this day, if I'm walking around my apartment and it's dark, I ask myself, is James McAvoy on the ceiling ready to turn me into his dinner?
And is he? Don't leave us hanging here.
Not yet. So far, not yet.
Okay. All right. Good. Well, enjoy scary movies if you wish. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.